Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend podcast for the weekend of July 18th, 2014. There are moments in life that transform us. Sometimes personal, like a marriage, a birth, a graduation. Sometimes massive, where you were when history happened. You pivot, respond, and move forward. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend. That's what we're talking about this week, those key moments. Scary ones overseas, quiet ones at home. If you've felt the ground shift under you, we want to hear about your experiences. So come talk to us online at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. But first, here's your economic week in 20 seconds.
Shares of Time Warner are soaring in the pre-market on reports that the media conglomerate rejected an $80 billion takeover offer from Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox.
Microsoft says it will eliminate up to 18,000 jobs over the next year.
We anticipate continuing to reduce the pace of our asset purchases.
Given its continued provocations in Ukraine, today I have approved a new set of sanctions on some of Russia's largest companies and financial institutions.
That is the president, of course, speaking about the new round of economic sanctions that his administration imposed on several Russian companies. We're going to start with those sanctions and the tragic downing of a Malaysia Airlines passenger jet in Ukraine. Steve Levine is a Washington correspondent for Quartz, and he teaches energy security at Georgetown University. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you very much.
Do you think this tragic event changes the picture of economic sanctions that we have already seen the Obama administration step up in the past week?
I think it does. The big problem in imposing an effective sanctions regime against Russia over the last few months since the Ukrainian crisis has erupted has been keeping Europe on board. And this, with so many European citizens having died on the plane, is going to change all that. It's a game changer. Suddenly you're going to see the U.S. and Europe marching the same direction. And you will see, I think, Europe imposing the same sorts of sanctions that we had Obama escalate over the last few days.
It can seem in some ways crass to talk about economics in sort of the aftermath of a human tragedy, but we're also trying to understand how all of these pieces fit together and are interconnected. You've spent a tremendous amount of time both in Russia and in the Caucasus, and I'd like you to tell me a little bit about how these kinds of sanctions and pronouncements from the West are often received in Russia.
That goes very, very far back. For hundreds of years, the West has had an antagonistic relationship with Russia, and Russia has felt itself misunderstood, disrespected, disregarded, and has had a chip on its shoulder because of that. So that when sanctions are issued against Russia, all of these instincts come to the surface, and there's not a real self-awareness, an accurate self-appraisal. Did I have any role in the events leading to this? And so even the current situation, I think it's going to be very, very hard for Russia to certainly publicly acknowledge some fault in the events and in having penalties imposed on them and on him.
I want to talk about some of the companies involved. Rosneft, we're talking about a massive petroleum company. Gazprom Bank, we're talking about a bank that funds the national oil and gas company. These are very big companies, but a lot of Americans may not know them. Connect the dots for me for how these giant corporations matter to someone who maybe fills up their tank in Oklahoma.
The first thing to know is that Russia has a very high percentage of the remaining oil and gas that exists on the planet. Over the last two or three years, Western, European, and U.S. companies have rushed into Russia and signed very, very large deals with Rosneft to drill in Siberia and in the Arctic. Russia produces 10 million barrels a day of oil and exports a lot of it. It's the second largest oil exporter on the planet. If those barrels were lost, you would see the price of oil skyrocket much higher than it is today, probably $200 a barrel and higher. Just to point out what the sanctions mean, the new ones that Obama imposed, what those do is Russia will continue to be able to produce and export the amount of oil that it currently does. But what Putin cares about the most is that he's going to be able to continue to do that over the length of his own reign and those of his successors. The oil deals that have been signed would allow Russia to continue to drill 10 million barrels a day of oil. The sanctions that are imposed make it very, very difficult to finance hundreds of billions of dollars of investment required to develop those fields.
So basically it's saying you might be able to do that, but you can't have access to U.S. dollars in trying to do that.
Global finance runs in one way or another through the U.S. system. It's either through a U.S. bank or you get a U.S. bank involved somehow in the transaction, or the money that is transferred from one place to another goes through the United States. So even though the sanctions are very, very narrowly written, they're very, very broad in impact. Basically, they freeze future development of big Russian oil projects.
Steve Levine from Quartz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. We want to talk about immigration now, as waves of undocumented immigrants from Latin America have been crossing the border into the U.S. Earlier this month, more than 100 people were put on a bus from Texas to a federal border patrol center in Marietta, California. It's a bedroom community about an hour from San Diego. Anti-illegal immigration protests broke out, and the buses were forced to turn back.
Take the 2.2 billion put them on airplanes and send them back down the door.
The past couple of weeks have not been anything like the Marietta that I know. There has been a media frenzy here. It's been a little bit crazy.
That's Kim Davidson, the business development manager for Marietta. We wanted to understand that pivotal moment when a city hoping to lure new business is thrust into the heated and emotional debate over immigration.
I think there was a couple of misperceptions that were played out in the media that helped to turn this into the frenzy that it ultimately turned into.
Boy, when you wake up and read a headline in the LA Times that says protesters in Marietta block detainees' buses, intense standoff, that's got to make you worry about growing businesses there.
Actually, it hasn't affected anything. I feel like the residents understand what went on and have not been paying too much attention to what's been going on in the media that claims otherwise. So as far as I'm concerned, the calls that I've been getting for permits that were already being pulled, for businesses that had already were already slated to come here. In fact, some of them were welcome phone calls within all of this, just asking me when they could come in and get their business license and giving me an update of when they were going to be open. And they really seem very unaffected by all of this altogether.
Nobody's saying, gosh, this is making me a little bit nervous. I know you've got Kaiser Permanente's in escrow, right? They're maybe going to put a lot of money into the city.
That's correct. And that is still moving forward as planned.
We sent a reporter down to Marietta. I know she talked to some of the different people there, and she did talk to residents who were protesting the buses. So it sounds like tensions are running high there regardless.
There were some residents out at the protest site, but from what we have been able to gather, most of the protesters out at the site were not from Marietta or this valley at all.
One of our reporters talked to the president of the Chamber of Commerce there, and he said, you know, there are some people who are concerned about what's going on. When you talk to people who own businesses and people who shop locally and drive their kids around, what's your message?
My message is that we did not intend for this to become a national platform for everyone to voice their opinion on immigration. We were only trying to ensure the safety of everyone, and that is what we will continue to do. For, I would say, the most part, in fact, I would say for the entirety of the people that I've talked to, we've also made ourselves very available to talk to everybody. I've been answering posts on Facebook, encouraging people to call us. We had one business owner that was posting some misinformation. I called him immediately.
What happened there?
he was just posting, he reposted some misinformation about that we tried to incite a protest regarding the immigration buses. And so I gave him a call and I just said, you know, do you understand the facts? I know what you saw on the media, but do you understand that we were just trying to protect the buses? We didn't turn them away. And so we had probably about a 30-minute chat on the phone. And by the time we went through everything, he agreed that it made more sense what I was talking about. He couldn't understand why he thought his city was reacting in this manner. And then once he found out that we were not, that it was a misperception being played out in the media, he apologized and immediately took down his post. I didn't ask him to take down his post. He offered to take down his post.
Marietta has a tech incubator. You guys have some other things where you, for example, rely on federal funding to get some grant money to bolster those things. Do you worry at all about your relationship with the federal government in this big back and forth that's been going on?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I worry about the perception that Marietta is getting across the board and that it's not the reality. It's based on rumor. It's based on some bird's eye camera views from the media that the real story may or may not truly be getting out there. That plays along with it. Saddens me what the perception of Marietta could be out either in the community, the nation, the world, and certainly at the federal level.
Kimberly Davidson, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Lizzie. I appreciate it.
That was Kim Davidson, Business Development Manager and Spokesperson for the City of Marietta, California. She joined us from City Hall. Coming up, when the love of your life has a money habit that you hate, what drives you nuts, and some advice on how to change things.
When it comes to couples communication, you always want to talk about what was your prior beliefs. Share stories about how you handled or how you saw your parents handle money.
And we'll do the weekend number. That's coming up next on Marketplace Weekend from APM. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. In this part of the show, we're going to talk about key personal moments when our hearts and wallets sometimes collide. This week, our listeners have been talking online about love and money and those things your partner does with money that drive you nuts. Certified financial planner Louis Barajas is here to help me out. Hi, Louis.
Hi, Lizzie.
How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Good. So we put this question out to our community on Twitter, on our website, on Facebook, and we wanted to know, you know, what are the things that your partner does that just drive you bananas? We collected a few responses, and I want to play them, and then you and I can sort of talk about them and the larger lessons gleaned from them. So let's listen.
My name is Doug. I'm calling from Denver. The thing that drives me crazy about my wife is how she treats checks that come to our house. She'll either leave them alone and won't deal with them for days, or she'll endorse them without restriction, and then they're as good as cash for anyone who picks them up.
This is Yale Hollander from St. Louis, Missouri, and the thing that irks me the most is when my wife logs a bunch of transactions in the check register and doesn't do the math.
My name is Shauna, calling from California, and the most annoying thing my partner has done financially is the time he went car shopping alone on his birthday and came home with a shiny new Audi, not the used Passat that we had discussed. I was so mad, I refused to ride in it for at least a week.
So much of these things seem to be about openness and communication. You've been doing this for a long time. What are the things you see that seem to drive people nuts? Is it about talking? Is that what's at the heart of this?
You know, it's interesting because I've seen worse behaviors than that. And I've always found that money really is all about a person's learned values, beliefs, attitudes. And, you know, this was a learned behavior. I'm almost trying to think that or believe that this gentleman who did that, who bought the car without his wife, kind of might have seen that happen in his household, maybe growing up.
Okay, so but all of this stuff is on a continuum, right? There are things that bother you, but you love your partner, and so who cares? At what point does it become worth it to say, hey, you know what, this is really bugging me?
I think you have to pick your battles, but, you know, when it really starts to affect the relationship, you have to start having conversations about this. And it always starts out with having some level of clarity as to how compatible you are when it comes to money and also what things create conflicts. And usually when we're going into a relationship, we don't talk about those things. But as they appear, as they're, you know, the ugly financial behavior appears, it's we need to bring those topics up to our spouse or our partner.
Yeah, money is such a taboo. You go out on a date with someone or you're getting to know them. You talk about all sorts of things, where you were brought up, what you like, what you don't like. How do you tease this stuff out? You know, what can you say? What can't you say? What have you seen work?
Well, money, I think, was a taboo at one point. I think people, because there are so many, you know, television shows about money, you know, internet sites about money, social media sites about money, that I don't think it's a taboo as much as it used to be. And I think there's nothing wrong with bringing it up on the first date. You know, when it comes to couples, you will always see that one of the top two reasons that people divorce or break up, it's because of money. And so when it comes to couples communication, you always want to talk about things that, you know, what was your prior beliefs? Share stories about how you handled or how you saw your parents handle money. Let the other person also share their stories. You want to see, again, if you're compatible. And also you want to see if there's going to be any conflict. For example, if you really love to save and you find out that your other partner loves to spend money, obviously there's going to be some conflict there. And at the same time, we find that when these habits become really annoying, people start hiding their habits from the other person, and then we fall into issues of trust and transparency.
Do you think it's okay for couples to, say, have separate accounts? Like, you know, they've got different values, they can't agree on how things are spent. What have you seen work?
No, you know, that doesn't work. And actually, that seems to make things worse. I think it really, really have to sit down and decide, okay, if, you know, you love to spend and I love to save, we have to find a common ground. And it's good for them to share accounts and spend money together and share their goals. It's okay to have a separate checking account for each other. But again, maybe for some minimal things. But if you're trying to really have a strong relationship based on trust, there has to be some level of transparency.
Some partners use money against one another. Say if somebody makes more, somebody stays home. How do you navigate that?
What you need to do is you need to be considerate of the other person as well, because you may not be making all the money forever. I mean, there are people who I've been working with for years who've made six figures and their spouse hasn't made as much money, not nearly half. And all of a sudden, through this great recession, they lost their jobs. The people earning the six figures lost their jobs. All of a sudden, they can't find a job. And some of them have been out of work for years. And all of a sudden, that power struggle is shifted. And so you have to be very conscious and considerate of the other person. But you're right. Money can be used to control other people.
Louis Barajas is a certified financial planner. Thank you so much, Louis.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Lizzie.
Next week, we want to talk about your basement, or maybe that spare bedroom. Was it ever occupied by a loved one for a little longer than you intended? How did you help get that person out of the house and onto their feet? Tell us at marketplaceweekend.org or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. We'll talk about what you talked about in next week's show. This is Marketplace Weekend from APM. Everybody has one, a moment or a story where money changes your life. Having it, not having it, maybe the first time you made some. This week, a stand-up comedian talks about how chasing your dream, even if it really is your dream, isn't a choice. It's an inevitability, one that can ruin you financially.
My name is Jimmy Pardo. I am the host of the award-winning podcast Never Not Funny. I'm also a regular on Conan. I'm also a decent guy. Right out of high school, I was working and managing record stores, and the brass ring when you work at a record store is to work for a record label. Those guys had it made. They're going to concerts, they're getting free records, they're wining and dining the clients. And I was lucky enough to get offered one of those jobs for MCA Records, making a terrific amount of money, a crazy amount of money, certainly for a kid who was 21, 22 years old, and everybody else were, you know, in their 30s and 40s and had, you know, been around since Elvis cut an album. I was the young upstart making a terrific living, but it wasn't fulfilling my need of what I wanted to do with my life. So I walked away from it to do stand-up comedy full-time. I was already doing a lot of shows around Chicago and making a little bit of change here and there, but not really, just doing open mics and making a couple of bucks. And that was what I had to do. It wasn't a want, it was a had. I had to do it. It was like, if I didn't do this, something would be wrong. You know, I remember going home and talking to my mom and stepdad about it, and they kind of understood it a little bit better than my father did. You know, my real dad was, he had never seen me do well as a comic. Every time he would come to a show, and maybe it's you want to make your dad proud or whatever, I would always bomb. And whenever my mom and stepdad would come, I would kill. So they kind of understood that I decided to go into comedy. My dad was like, hey, what are you doing here? So that's you've got the dream job. What are you doing? But it wasn't the dream job. Stand-up was. I had to at least give it a try and see what happened. And when I went in and I quit, I sat down with my boss, Jim, and I told him I was leaving. And then at the morning meeting, he told the entire staff that I was going to be leaving the company to pursue stand-up comedy, and their eyes jumped out like Roger Rabbit's. I took the chance. I rolled the dice. You know, making the jump from six figures to three figures a week, it was crazy. You know, drive all over the country to make $100 a night, which then after gas and whatever, ended up being, what, $30 a night? And it wasn't good. Just trying to keep the wallet tight, but still living like I was making that MCA money. I had a $600 car payment, which was insane. You know, the early 90s, I had a Chrysler LeBaron convertible, which was a horrible car to have in the Midwest during the winter. It was never occurring to me like, oh, you don't have the money to pay these bills now. I got myself, my first 5 years in comedy, just found myself getting, 5 to 8 years, getting deeper and deeper and deeper in debt. $70,000 in debt, or maybe even more. I don't remember what the actual figure was. And then in 1998, I declared bankruptcy. Which went against everything that I was as a human being. I'm not a quitter. I've been working since I was a kid, but I didn't have a choice. I was drowning. You know, I guess now having a son myself, I would obviously never stop him from pursuing his dream. My son, God forbid, wanted to get into this business. You know, I would understand it, but I might advise him a little differently on how to handle your money when you get there. And maybe that's what my dad was trying to do when he thought it was a mistake for me to leave this great job and pursue stand-up. But I, it's not something you have a choice over. You have to just do it. When you're an entertainer, I don't think you have a choice.
That was Jimmy Pardo's journey from record label employee to successful professional stand-up. You can catch him as a regular on Conan on TBS or check out his comedy podcast. It's called Never Not Funny. Sometimes there are fights in Washington that can seem just plain confusing from the outside, like the current brawl over the Export-Import Bank. You may not even know about this federal agency. People call it the Ex-Im Bank, but its charter expires in September. Many conservative Republicans would like to kill it entirely, but some other folks in the GOP, joined by Democrats and a lot of business types, want to keep the Ex-Im Bank around. Whatever happens means a lot for American businesses. To explain what Ex-Im does and put it in context, we took a little field trip.
Right. Well, maybe we'll try the other office.
It's not every day that you find yourself on the 16th floor of a 27-story office building in Manhattan's Garment District with an 85-year-old man critiquing your outfit.
What is this pants fabric?
It is a stretch synthetic. Probably Lycra. Okay?
And what about my shirt?
I don't know where you got it. Lord and Taylor?
Yeah, I got it on the internet.
Yeah, right. It's a different world. I knew exactly what you were wearing.
Really?
Yes. Well, I've been around for a few weeks.
Actually, Irving Marx has been in textiles for a while.
1954 is how many years? It's 46, almost 60 years I've been doing it. There isn't a fabric in the world that I'm not familiar with.
Marx sells fabrics, wholesale.
So when someone comes to me and says to me they're looking for a pants, polycotton twill, we have to know exactly what you're talking about.
But we're not talking to Marx because of polycotton twill. We came to talk about the Export-Import Bank, because Marx benefited from about $800,000 from the Ex-Im Bank during a 10-year stretch, according to the bank. And it's important to note, that's not money Marx received. The bank does business by making loans, credit insurance, or loan guarantees to customers who buy from American exporters, like Irving Marx.
And explain to me how that worked.
They came to me offering me a deal where they would guarantee my export sales. I would have to submit to them the invoice. They would give me an approval to ship, and I would ship.
Basically, in terms of the business model,
it was a good idea. It encouraged
me. They were guaranteeing your sales.
And that was a good idea for me, and a good idea for many others, because there was no way people of my size, which was comparatively small, could ship all over the world without the knowledge that we would get paid.
What was the difference, do you think, when you had that guarantee and when you didn't?
Well, when we had the guarantee, it made us fearless. We took orders from people we don't really know, who don't speak even English. In most cases, we were paid, and if we were not paid, we knew Ex-Im Bank would pay the bill.
Do you have a sense of how much money it made you?
Well, we worked basically on a 10 to 15% markup, so if I did $1 million, it would be $150,000 gross.
And how about now, without it?
We do without it. We don't sell. It has cut back on my sales. There's no question about it. I could do triple my business tomorrow if I had Ex-Im Bank in place.
Mark says he had a big billing dispute with Ex-Im a few years back, and since then he can't get loans from them. That idea of having access to Ex-Im, then not, brings us back to the big debate in Congress. Supporters of Ex-Im say small businesses would suffer, as Marx has, if Ex-Im went away. But supporters of reform or doing away with the bank entirely say Ex-Im is just a form of corporate welfare.
Unfortunately, you know, facts, as is often the case in the political arena, get thrown around, and there's a bit of truth on all sides.
That's Jan Boyer. He's an entrepreneur who specializes in emerging markets, and he was also a senior advisor to President George W. Bush. And Boyer says while a lot of little loans benefit small businesses, there are a few huge loans that aid big companies.
Those that are in favor of what the Ex-Im Bank is doing point out that 90% of their loans go to small companies. But if one sort of looks at it from a different point of view and says, well, of the percentage of total dollars that get deployed, how much are going to big companies? The facts are that 60% of their money goes to 10 very big companies.
We've seen a big decline in what America makes and exports abroad. Now, some of that has changed recently, but it's a lot cheaper to make stuff overseas than it is to do it here. Do you think Ex-Im has made a difference in helping U.S. exports?
You know, the short answer is yes, but it's a qualified yes. What I think is most important to focus on is could I make that additional sale in another country without that financing? And I'll give you sort of an extreme example. You know, if we're talking selling something in Mexico, one could think and imagine that, you know, if you're a businessman in Oregon and you had a business that's, you know, growing and being successful, you wanted to finance some sales to Mexico, your local banker you could talk to, you could persuade that this is a smart business decision and could you please support me? Now, if instead there was an opportunity for that same company in Oregon to sell in Afghanistan, to sell in Pakistan, to sell in Indonesia, probably the conversation between that entrepreneur and his local banker would not be very successful.
So Ex-Im is helpful in getting U.S. products into riskier markets?
Yes. Certain companies, I would argue, it's the difference between them doing it and not doing it. But in the case of other companies, many other companies, it's really it's not a question of being helpful or making a difference. It's a question of making it cheaper to them. And therefore, there's some truth also in the fact that Ex-Im is not necessary for certain companies or is not the differentiating factor. But in the case of other companies, absolutely it is.
Jan Boyer, thank you so much for talking with me.
It is my pleasure, Lizzie. Thanks for having me.
And that brings us to the weekend number. Regardless of where you stand on the Export-Import Bank, here's some positive news about U.S. exports. They're growing. In the past year, the U.S. exported $2.3 trillion worth of goods. That's almost 46% more than we were exporting back in 2009, during the depths of the financial crisis. Up next on Marketplace Weekend, keeping your data safe when you trade in your smartphone.
You definitely want to always want to wipe your data before you do any reselling.
That and the surprisingly small wealth gap in Denmark. Stick around. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. There are pivotal moments where money, government, and how we live collide. One of them may have happened this week when the Attorney General of Illinois sued two student loan debt settlement companies over what she calls deceptive practices. Right now, student loan debt totals $1.2 trillion in this country. So people are watching this suit closely. And so are you, on Facebook, online. Lots of people were talking about this story. So we asked our reporter, Adrian Hill, to come on and tell us more about what's going on. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
Can you explain for us what these companies were doing and the suit that Lisa Madigan filed in Illinois?
Yeah. So these two companies, we have Broadsword Student Advantage and First American Tax Defense, allegedly charged people for student loan debt relief that they never actually provided in many cases. In other cases, they charged people for relief that's available for free online from the government. And at least one of these companies advertised something it called the Obama Forgiveness Plan, which doesn't actually exist.
That's yes. A little problematic. And people were paying for these, right? I mean, how much were they shelling out to get some relief from their loan burdens?
Well, Broadsword was allegedly charging $500 up front and a monthly fee of about $50. First American Tax Defense was charging as much as $1,200 in upfront fees. You know, the National Consumer Law Center looked more broadly at this industry, which has really been growing, and it found some of these companies charge people $1,600 plus monthly fees for these services.
I think if you talk to anyone below a certain age, most of us either have carried or still carry a lot of student debt. It's really something that I think resonates with a lot of people. And I guess one question I have is, why do people fall for these scams?
Well, look, I mean, there are 7 million people in this country right now behind on $100 billion of student loan debt. There are a lot of people out there desperate to figure out how to get out of this burden, and it's really complicated. Experts I talked to said, look, the federal government does not make this easy. And so when you combine people sort of who are desperate, who are way behind, with a system that isn't easy, that isn't intuitive, and lots of times people don't know about, they look for help. And the help they can find comes from these companies.
So let's look forward a little bit. You know, in Illinois or in other places, what's Lisa Madigan hoping comes out of all of this? She's Illinois' attorney general.
She's Illinois' attorney general. She says, look, these companies are illegal. They violated laws, consumer fraud laws. Experts I talked to thought we'd see more similar lawsuits from other states' attorneys general. So we might see that going forward. I think this case is also getting the word out to people, and I think maybe that's part of it, that the federal government offers a lot of these services for free online. So you can go online and apply to consolidate your loans. You can go online and learn about the loan forgiveness programs that are out there.
And those are legitimate, those are real, and
these are
most importantly, those
federal
are free.
Government. They are free. Studentloans.gov, studentaid.gov, check it out. That is where sort of these legitimate programs are to help people out.
Let's say you don't live in Illinois, but you did get defrauded, or you think maybe you've been defrauded by one of these companies or a company like this. What are your options?
Well, you can file a formal complaint with the Federal Trade Commission. Apparently, the number of complaints they've been getting about debt relief programs has been going up and up and up. You might contact your own state attorney general. Lisa Madigan's office says there were a number of complaints her office got about these companies before she filed suit.
I want you to look into your crystal ball for us a little bit.
Whoa.
Give us a little bit of a... Yeah. Give us a little bit of a peek of what you're working on. You're looking into all sorts of cool issues surrounding education.
We're spending the year taking a look at the way technology is changing education and changing the classroom. You know, one thing that's been on my mind, Lizzie, is thinking about what the physical structure of a school might look like in the future. Because maybe if we're rethinking how we're teaching kids, we don't need the classroom that we know today.
So all that stuff that we're used to, desks and chairs
and thing, classrooms.
You know, molded together in
blow
classrooms.
It up. Rethink it.
That's a totally different way of learning.
Yes, it is.
Adrienne Hill, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
I can't get Mario Brothers to work, dude.
Dude, you have to blow in the cartridge.
I'm not going to blow in the cartridge.
Dude, you
that
have
is
to
so
blow
stupid.
In the cartridge.
I'm not.
Fine. See, I told you.
This is tech in real life.
Our guide to tech in real life this week is Haley Sukiyama. She is a tech reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote an article about how much personal information is left over on our smartphones. And then there was a study about this. I was kind of stunned about all of this information. Tell me about sort of the digital record we leave behind.
So what was interesting about the study, which looked at Android phones, this security company, Avast, bought 20 used smartphones. And these were all smartphones that people had erased the data off of. And they were able to recover, using their own tools, they were able to recover, you know, pictures of people's kids and, you know, kind of all the personal things you take on your phone that you don't necessarily want to go over into the next owner. And so even though these people had erased their data, they were able to recover it. And, you know, that's really kind of disturbing if you think about it.
And all of these things that were on there, people thought they'd gotten rid of all this stuff, right?
Yeah, they'd used the sort of default factory reset wipe, which, you know, you see on every Android phone, where you can go into settings and security and get rid of it. And so that was, you know, just sort of the default tool that everybody thinks to use before they sell their phone. But it didn't get rid of all the data quite as completely as a lot of people would have liked.
All right. So if you want to be practical and you want to be safe, what can you do if you want to sell your phone and you want to be safer?
If you're an Android user, one thing that you can do is encrypt the data before you wipe it. It's probably a good practice to encrypt your data anyway, which Android will let you do in the security settings. So basically, encrypting the data just means you jumble it up so that nobody else can look at it unless they have your password. Sort of regardless of what kind of phone you have, you should also be thinking about things like expandable memory cards and the SIM card. A lot of Android phones let you add a memory card to expand the amount of memory that you have on the phone, and you can store a lot of sort of personal files and photos on there. Before you sell the phone, be sure that you take out the card. If you have it, then nobody else can have it, and then your data is safe.
This study and a lot of these tips are geared toward people with Android phones. What about iPhones? What are the things to think about if you're someone who runs on the Apple system and who has an iPhone?
The great thing about Apple is that they have encrypted their data on their phones. But, you know, it's a good idea that the SIM card rule applies. And, of course, you definitely always want to wipe your data before you do any reselling.
You know, we live in such a fast-moving, digitally dependent world. I mean, I use my phone for so many things that I couldn't even conceive of using a phone for 5 years ago. Do we always run the risk in the future of some release of personal information?
You know, I mean, I'm not a futurist and I don't have a crystal ball, but I do think that certainly the amount of personal data that we are putting on these devices or, you know, in the cloud definitely opens us up to that risk. The ultimate security guide to reselling your phone is to not, for example, take racy pictures of yourself in the first place, because then they don't exist and nobody can ever see them.
Haley Sukuyama is a reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. This week, the online real estate company Trulia released a study that caught our eye. Millennials are buying homes at the same rate as previous generations. They're just waiting till they're a little bit older than their Generation X and baby boomer counterparts. Now, this study, and it's only just one study, goes against conventional wisdom that pins sluggish home sales on millennials foregoing that big purchase. Of course, not everyone under 30 wants a dream home. Some people are just looking for a space to dream. Take this story from Sarah Merck.
The biggest thing I own is my mattress. Some people have trucks or boats or houses or heirloom chests of drawers or ambitiously large desks or ill-conceived contemporary art pieces. But the most impressive thing I own is just this big, squishy rectangle. It might not seem like much, but getting this mattress was a major life step for me. When I first moved to Portland, Oregon 6 years ago, I was determined to furnish my room only through things I could get for free. This sounds like a bohemian ideal, but factoring into my ethics was the fact that I was dang near broke. The truth, though, is that even when I got a job, soon after Obama was inaugurated, I was scared to buy anything remotely nice, like a blender or a sofa that didn't smell like cats. So when a roommate offered me his old futon frame and pad from the basement, claiming it was like sleeping on a cloud, I gladly took him up on the offer. That futon turned out to be a cloud made of stabby wooden railroad slats. But it was my accursed futon now, and I was grateful. I know I'm supposed to view large, expensive items as investments. I feel like I'm supposed to go into debt for things because they'll wind up helping me in the long run. But I came of age in a time when the absurdity of the whole credit system became tragically clear. The people running the economy reminded me of Gene Wilder's version of Willy Wonka. Mysterious men running around, gleefully pulling levers, but unleashed sweet rewards on some and chaos on others. When I was a kid, I remember debt stalking my parents like a silent, gloomy cloud. The day they finally paid off their credit cards, they cut them up in front of me, and we ordered pizza to celebrate. Years later, I spent a week helping tear down sodden houses in Mobile, Alabama, after Hurricane Katrina tore through and flooded whole neighborhoods. I spent days shoveling people's possessions into giant piles in the gutter, carpets, entire moldy bookshelves, waterlogged TVs. All signs seemed to point to the conclusion that big possessions, requiring a mortgage and a car payment and a cable bill, would become an anchor, dragging me underwater. I realized, slowly, that I'm not a bohemian free spirit. I'm a frugal cynic. Back on that horrible slab of a futon, I toughed out the nights for 2 years, until my very sweet new boyfriend finally cracked. He told me in no uncertain terms that I either needed to get an actual mattress or he was never sleeping at my house again. But I protested, I can't just buy a mattress. Yet he had a point. So I dutifully went to IKEA on the bus and walked up the trail to the bedroom section to the gauntlet of modernist bed frames, eyeballing prices. Around me, cheerful couples were buying mattresses, joyfully betting on a stable future full of new furniture and reliable middle-class jobs. That's the IKEA spirit. I felt so out of place that I turned heel and left in defeat. After another night, gathering my resolve while lying on the wooden planks, I gave it another shot. heading to a family-run mattress store near my house. It was empty when I walked in. Without the oppressively upbeat surroundings, I actually liked looking at the beds. I flopped on one after another. They were so comfy. It dawned on me that a bed was not a dangerous luxury item that would trap me. This was a bed. Come bull market or bailout, you need a bed. It's okay to buy something that I'll appreciate for years and years, I realized, even if I don't know what those years will look like. I paid $300 for a springy queen-size mattress, and I felt good. I've had that mattress for 4 years now. At the end of each chaotic day, it's nice to come home to a stable and cozy place. And besides, worst case scenario, it can always double as a life raft.
Sarah Merck is the host of the podcast Popaganda.
We're going to end the show talking about happiness. We've all heard the saying that money can't buy it, but what about how much money you've got compared to your neighbor? People in Denmark routinely rank as the happiest people on Earth, according to the United Nations, and Denmark also has the second smallest wealth gap among industrialized countries. So we called up Ole Mikkelsen, the bureau chief for Thomson Reuters in Copenhagen. He says Danish happiness is really about day-to-day economic security.
At the same time, it's very safe to be around here. The average Dane is driving a Volkswagen, including myself. It's not the cheapest car, but it's safe and reliable. Around half of the Danes live in their own house, while the rest are renting. I think it's quite different from the U.S.,
It's very different from the U.S., and you all have a very large number of stipends for different things, for having children, for going to school, for looking for work. Can you run me through kind of the different kinds of social welfare programs that exist?
Well, it's basically free, all the welfare. The schools are free, and it's free to go to the university. But you have to remember that it means we have the highest taxes in the world at the same time.
Denmark is considered the happiest country in the world. Do you think these two things go hand in hand, this question of inequality and happiness?
I think so, yes. And of course, we have low unemployment rates. And during the financial crisis, the unemployment rate was not affected dramatically. It was kind of stable during the financial crisis, and it might be because around one third of the population is actually working for the public sector, so the public sector did not cut back as, let's say, big corporate did during the crisis.
It seems when you look at the numbers that the top 20% of Danes, who earn on average four times as much as the bottom 20%, you don't have the kind of elite that we see in many other developed countries. Why is that, do you think?
I think it's mainly because of the high taxes. It's quite difficult to be ultra rich like what you see in like in the United States or in UK or Middle East or something. It would be companies. They are making a lot of money, but it's not going to one person or one family.
Ole Mikkelsen, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
And that's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next week, we're going to have some brunch and find out how you got your kids out of the basement and back up on their feet. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, John Sepulvedo, and Candice Manriquez. A special thanks to Candice. This is her last show before she heads to grad school. We appreciate everything she's done and wish her the best of luck in her new adventure. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Brendan Willard is our engineer. Our theme music was composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you next weekend.
This is APM.